future. There are no people. There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, how are you doing tonight? Just sending out the last minute notification out there that we are, yes, indeed, live. It is Monday, September 27th, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Live. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and, yes, from across the country. On Fridays, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And on Wednesdays, yes, we have the Wednesday show with Cyril Mikulenko. We're still on kind of like an every other week going here on Wednesdays. Cyril's a progressive columnist from the Bucks County Courier-Times, the Intelligencer. And he joins me to drill down into Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and international politics and talk about his latest column. He's got a great one coming out this week, and so we'll be on again next Wednesday to talk about his latest column. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can help support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just head on over to patreon.com/rcpress, and you can become a patron for as little as $5 a month. And if you're listening to this show on the Podbean app, well, you can show us some love right now by hitting that green patron button at the top of the page as you're listening. And if you really want to help us out, you can do it. It won't even cost you a dime. Head on over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already and smash that subscribe button, like the stream for the show, and hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live. You know, we started doing some our YouTube streaming a little bit kind of on a whim, just looking for some new things to do, wanted to try some stuff out, and it's been great. And then we started putting appeal out to folks, hey, look, you know, it looks like this, you know, we think we're going to keep the YouTube stream going up. Instead of just doing occasional interviews, we're actually going to regular stream our shows. And now we just cracked the 150 subscriber button, or subscribers to the channel, which is great. I think we're at 157 as of this show tonight. I'd love to see that get to over 200. We get to over 200 subscribers, right? I mean, all you got to do is you hit subscribe to the show. It doesn't cost you a dime. You're not getting notifications in your email all the time, like saying, please, please watch this show. No. But when we go live, you might get a little notification on your YouTube channel, all right? But so if you head on over there, doesn't hurt, doesn't cost you anything. Head on over there, takes just a couple seconds. Hit that subscribe button. Let's help get us over the 200 subscriber mark. That'll be our next little goal, I guess. We're also broadcasting live on Riverside.fm. You can join us on Riverside.fm, and you can call into the show during the second part of the show tonight. Or really, tonight's all call-in show, so you can call in anytime you want, really. You just got to head on over there. I'm going to put the information for that directly into our... I'll do it right now, actually. Directly on our YouTube chat. So here's the call-in info for everybody. You can go ahead and check it out on Riverside, and you can listen right there on Riverside.fm, and then listen as an audience member. And if you want to call in, there's a little call-in button there. One thing I do want to kind of emphasize is just like if you're calling into a radio show, right? There's a little bit of a delay. You don't want to give feedback. So if you are going to call into the show and you're listening on YouTube, make sure you shut that YouTube down or at least mute it, and watch and listen on Riverside.fm, so you avoid any of the feedback and delays in the call. That was a little divergence here. You can also join our Discord server. Info on that is in today's show notes on YouTube and in the podcast, of course. That doesn't cost you a dime either. For more PA Progressive Talk, tune into the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, Facebook. You know, basically wherever you're streaming, you're going to find Rick. And make sure you subscribe to his daily podcast wherever you get your podcast. And head on over to ricksmithshow.com, thericksmithshow.com, for all the latest across all those platforms. I mean, he's got a show, WBAI in New York, WPFK, I believe it is, out in Los Angeles. I mean, his show has been taken off, and it's like a long time coming. You know, Rick once said to me, too, is like, you know, it's about staying in the room. You know, you figure that you stay in the room long enough, eventually someone's going to listen. Well, I'll tell you, someone's going to kind of like pay attention. And I'll tell you, this is the year that, man, a lot of people are listening. So congratulations to Rick and his producer, Brett, for doing just some amazing work over there on the Rick Smith Show. And you got to check out the Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Speaking of awesome podcasts, the amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Yep, make sure to follow them on Twitter at the Night Caucus. That's at the Night Caucus on Twitter. And subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. And for all the gamers out there, the Game Inn, that's with two N's, the Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show, and they've got everything from retro N64s to latest consoles, video games for all platforms, and loads of collectibles, action figures, and Funko Pops. And you know what? Kids are back in school. You know what that means. When the report cards start coming in and they get A's in that report card, send them on over to the Game Inn, and they'll get a discount for every A. Check them out on their Facebook page at The Game Inn. Follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn with two N's. You got a question about a game, look for something particular, you know, shoot them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com and check out all their great stuff. Special shout out goes once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at @songadayman. That's at @songadayman with two N's on Twitter. Well, on today's show, you know, if you were listening to our show on Friday this week, you know that I was being a little dodgy on what this tonight's show was going to be like. I had hoped that we might have a guest tonight, but it just didn't pan out in terms of making, you know, getting schedules together and all that stuff, you know, which is fine. And so we just thought, instead of trying to kind of rush together, you know, try to squeeze someone in for tonight, I just thought I'd do another call-in show. And, you know, I was thinking about when we first started doing this Monday Night Live show, we did it on the Podbean app, right? And we did a call-in show, and which was cool. And we did a live stream show there. And then we started having guests on the show and making a more regular thing, which is pretty cool. But, you know, there's one thing that was awesome about the early days of doing that live show on Monday on the Podbean app is there were a few nights where we just started, you know, getting calls in from people across the country. I remember this, I wish I could remember his handle, but I remember this one guy I was talking to called in from Texas. And we were talking about some of the politics in Texas, and then we had someone else that called in one night from Canada, and we chatted a bit what was happening over there. And it was just kind of nice little community that was forming. And I was thinking about this today, and I was like, you know, yeah, I really got to find a way of maybe, you know, like scheduling a night like that, just, you know, even if it's once a month. So maybe, you know, three nights of interviews, three Mondays of interviews, and then one of the kind of open phones is kind of a regular thing, and really plugging it primarily on Riverside.fm, you know, so we have kind of more calls in for listeners and stuff, because, you know, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed when people were calling in, just like on this show, for example, when we get all the comments that are coming in on our YouTube channel. It's just great to hear from folks. So it's all good. Tonight, there's a lot of stuff happening kind of around the country and everything, and a lot of things happening in our neck of the woods. I mean, you've got school board meetings right here in Bucks County, and we've been reporting a lot on the Bucks County school board meetings. I know at Kutztown University, there's a meeting going on, organizing meeting going on about Kutztown University's COVID procedures and stuff. And that's there. And so, you know, there's a lot of people there. And you know what? There's a lot of people who are enjoying this freaking awesome weather that's kind of hung around through the weekend. I know I took a little break for the most part from social media and really the computer in general over the weekend. Did some yard work, spent a lot of time outside, and it felt really good. You know, and I was trying to remember if it had been, if the weather had just not been really good, or, you know, what was going on. But man, it just felt like a great weekend to be outside, you know. So I trimmed this tree that it's been tension for a while, and just, you know, just did some good stuff. So it's been that kind of weekend. And then meanwhile, you've got tons of stuff that's been going on. So I'd love to hear from you. If you got questions, you got comments, you want to call in, you want to throw comments into our YouTube stream, that'd be fantastic. But you know, I'll tell you a little bit what's going on in my neck of the woods. So, yeah, So anyways, so I've got a, there's a few things that we'll kind of like to get into. And, you know, I've been doing a lot of, you know, just reading through different stuff and trying to make sense of a lot of things that are going on right now. And because like it's a big week at the national level. I mean, basically this week is, this week we're going to see if Joe Biden's fairly ambitious agenda dies, right? Or if we get to see Democrats actually step up to the plate and actually pass something big. You know, there's been a lot of attention being paid to West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who has basically put his thumb on the scale in this bill to basically ensure that it, you know, continues, it does not harm the fossil fuel industry, which means does not, you know, harm his personal wealth, because he is, of course, you know, coal baron after all. And his son runs the coal business. So, you know, we shall see. We shall see what happens here. Nancy Pelosi came out over the weekend on Sunday and she sent a letter to her colleagues, her dear colleagues' letters. I freaking hate these things, but whatever. And basically said, hey, we're going to do it this week. We're going to pass the infrastructure, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which that's the one that Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in particular got all these kudos for, because they wanted to work on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And they came up with this kind of $1 trillion package, $1+ trillion package for infrastructure. And it's, you know, kind of the hard infrastructure that powers the, you know, that still stems from the fossil fuel infrastructure that, you know, that we have to put to bed. But nonetheless, like roads and bridges and all that stuff, which is, you know, needed to do, there's no doubt about that, has to be done. Kudos to actually getting some money in the, you know, in the stream here. And the reason why there was that separate process, that separate infrastructure bill process, is because, you know, a bunch of Republicans and Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, basically were saying, you know, we don't like Biden's full package. You know, we don't like all this stuff that he's going to put in the infrastructure, you know, bill for like education and home health care and guaranteed universal child care, you know, preschool kind of thing. We don't like all the climate infrastructure stuff in there that's going to prepare us, you know, to, you know, ideally, you know, stave off the worst effects of climate change. Although, you know, the clock has been ticking on that, and it looks increasingly dire that that human beings across the planet are actually going to, and those, you know, those in power, I should say, human beings, those in power across the planet are actually going to stand up and do the necessary things required to meet the challenges of this climate crisis. So yeah, so, you know, Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin didn't want to vote for any of that stuff, any of those things that would help kind of everyday working people, anything that would help kind of stave off kind of catastrophe for future generations. They didn't want to touch that stuff. What they wanted to do is just wanted to focus on stuff that they knew. We want to make sure that the roads are built so that more cars keep on going, so the gas keeps flowing and the oil keeps flowing and the pipelines keep flowing, all the quote unquote what they're calling the hard infrastructure. Right. But really, I think we should be thinking about that as the fossil fuel infrastructure is really what they are all getting behind. So they passed that. But the deal was, OK, look, we'll let you do this. And even Biden came out and says, we'll let you do this. You want to get this bipartisan thing so you can say that you worked in a bipartisan manner in order to come up with something for infrastructure? Fine. But there's going to be an exchange here. Right. It's going to be like, we'll give you the space to do this. And in exchange for that, we're going to put together this reconciliation bill package, right? If you remember, originally, this was a $6 trillion reconciliation package, which was designed to do all those things that Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin and some others refused to kind of take part in. And that would be the climate mitigation stuff, building out the climate infrastructure, hardening our infrastructure for the climate crisis, right? Building out our kind of electrical grid that would make it capable to handle the different kinds of challenges and demands of a solar and a wind-based power, electrical power grid, right? Because there's different, you know, it functions in a different way. So you have to build that out. And that was in the bill. Also, the things, you know, our infrastructure, our caring infrastructure, if you will, right, our human infrastructure, if you will, that has been left to wither on the vine, like education, like healthcare, like childcare, right? All this stuff, you know, people just basically trying to piece together lives where they can manage all this stuff. People being kind of left, you know, to fend for themselves when we should be kind of taking care of each other. All that stuff is kind of built into this. And I think, you know, look, I give a ton of credit to the Biden administration for really putting that front and center and calling it infrastructure, because that's what it is, right? Infrastructure doesn't mean roads and bridges, right? It only takes on that meaning when we're thinking about the society in which it supports. So just like anything else, right? If you have a structure, right? If you want to have a society that you want to build, it needs to, there's necessary things for that society, right? And in the fossil fuel system, for example, you know, like pipelines, right? You have a drilling rig, right? That goes into the ground and takes out the oil and the gas and runs it through a pipeline to a refinery, right? All that is infrastructure based upon a fossil fuel economy, right? We could take another kind of economy or another kind of society. Let's take a dictatorship, right? You have a dictatorship, say it's a military dictatorship, right? Well, then you basically need lines of command and you need a large military, right? And you need to have a legal infrastructure that empowers that kind of military, right, to enact and carry out its will on the populace, right? And we have a decision-making infrastructure in a dictatorship, which is top-down, right? And everything starts from the dictator, right? And those orders filter out. So there's a communication infrastructure, and there's a violence infrastructure, monopoly of violence infrastructure that carries it out. We see that, you know, in our own police forces and stuff, right? But you could use your imagination, right? Any society that you could imagine, right, isn't just a society in its ideas. Like, so we say, oh, we're a republic, we're a democracy, right? Democracy is a, well, those things function. They have an infrastructure that supports that. And right now we're at a moment in history in which we must have a significant shift in the way that our society functions, period. And you need the infrastructure to build it. So that's everything that's in that reconciliation bill, right? And Bernie Sanders, you know, head of the budget committee, when they kind of put together the original reconciliation bill, it was a $6 trillion package, right? And that would have, and it's $6 trillion over 10 years, right? So, and that would have built out, that would have really made substantial investments in making that shift, like, towards a caring economy, towards a post-fossil fuel-based economy, right? And that's already been whittled down. It's almost to half, right? Where it sits now, right, the compromise reconciliation bill is $3.5 trillion over 10 years. It's almost half. And now you've got Joe Manchin and some corporate Democrats in the House that are basically saying, nope, that's too much. They won't tell you what's enough, but that's too much. And they want to bring it down even further, which will basically guarantee that the final version of the bill. So let's say they whittle it down in half again, and that brings it down to what? $1.75 trillion, $1.5 trillion, $1.7 trillion. Let's just say that. And I wish I could remember where I heard this the other day, but they, you know, I think they put it exactly right. I don't know who said this, but I think they put it absolutely right. So they have a choice to make. I think it was Sam Cedar. I think it was probably Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, or maybe it was Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It was one of the two. I'm just saying they're going to be left with a choice. The choice is between doing some of the things and having to make choices over which things you do and which things you don't do, and pitting those things against you. So do you basically provide universal child care, or do you do climate? I mean, I don't know if those would be two of the trade-offs, but you'd have to have those kind of choices. Which communities are you going to leave, you know, are you going to, you know, hang out to dry? who's going to be left to fend for themselves? Because you're basically saying with $1.7 trillion as that second part of the infrastructure bill, that human infrastructure bill, there's no way that you're basically going to create a just society. Nope, you're going to leave people out. And so now you're in the business of choosing who gets left out. Right? Who's in and who's out? And we know how that plays out. That means it's going to fall along racial lines, around class lines and gender lines. Guaranteed. That is at the core. That's like in the genetic makeup of this country. Right? So if you leave it to default and you ask who's in and who's out and you have to pit people against each other, then you're basically going to repeat and reinforce racist, sexist, classist systems. And you're going to give a win back over to runaway corporate capitalism, right? Or you make a different kind of choice. No, we're going to do everything in that bill. But we're going to do everything badly. Like, in other words, you could do everything at half the cost, but that means you're going to get half the service. It's going to be half as good. Right? You think about, you go to a store, right? And this happens to me all the time now, right? In the kind of post-COVID era, right? So you go to a store and at certain times of the day, right? You have somebody that gets really busy, sometimes it goes up, but you have enough staff, right? So that when it gets busy, you pull people from like the back, just say it's a grocery store, right? You pull people who are doing stocking or who are kind of loading things up or kind of organizing stuff or going through inventory. When it gets busy, you pull people in and then, you go ahead and, you take care of it because you don't want the lines to be really long. Why? Because you want the experience of the service to be positive. You want people to come back. Right? But if you cut half your workforce, right? You basically say we have three cashiers and that's all we're going to have. Right? We know in the past at peak times we've needed nine, but we only have money for three. So we're going to spend a little money on these self-checkout lanes over there, but we're going to have three people. And so what happens when those peak times come? Sometimes they're predictable, sometimes they're not. You end up waiting in long lines. That's austerity for you right there. And so basically we get to do even the $3.5 trillion for that bill is going to be a strain. But whatever. It's better than nothing. It's not as good as the $6 trillion that was originally proposed, but there you go. So all this is coming to head this week, right? Because the deal was that you vote for that bipartisan bill. Okay, you could pass it. But that means we also got to pass the reconciliation bill. And they're going to go as a package. And progressives have said, that's right. That's part of the deal. You want our support for the infrastructure bill? Then you have to kind of pass that other side in the Senate. And both those bills go forward at the same time. Well, that all comes to a head this week. Nancy Pelosi and them have said that this is the week for infrastructure. This is also the week where they have to pass the budget ceiling. Whether, we're going to have a budget shutdown, all this kind of stuff is coming to a head. So the question is, are the Democrats going to hold together? Nancy Pelosi said she's going to put the vote on the, vote on the floor for that bipartisan infrastructure bill. But there's no deal on the reconciliation. Manchin and Sinema and these folks are like, I don't know. So now Pramila Jayapal, right, she's the head of the Progressive Caucus, is being said, look, we got 50 to 60 votes here. They are not going to vote for that bipartisan bill unless we get this stuff on the other one. Yes, we're willing to sink that bill if they break the deal. The deal was they go together. And now they're reneging on that part of the deal. So we're reneging on the other side of it. You want to step out, you break the deal, you go up, right? Basic diplomacy. But, just like the corporate media is in this country, right? So what they're doing now is they're going and they're, blaming the progressives, right? And they want the progressives to cave. And then you got these freaking corporate Democrats, I swear to God, It's driving me nuts. Coming out and basically saying things like, oh, well, you know, I think we got to put, you know, using the Joe Manchin, like, well, you know, we got to pass this infrastructure. We could do that now. We can put the shovels in the ground right away. And we'll still have time to do that other thing. And anybody who's been paying half attention to anything that's been going on in our government knows that that's a load of garbage, that they will never do it. If there is no pressure upon these people to do the right thing, they will not do it. So you have to find ways to put pressure on them. There are some good ways of doing it. Anyways, so that's a big deal. We'll see what happens this week. Are the Democrats going to hold? Are the Progressive Caucus going to hold and basically say, no, yeah, we're going to vote down that other bill? I don't know. We shall see. You know, in something a little bit closer to home, I was so pissed off about this. This is an article from the Morning Call. It's based in Allentown by Anthony Salamone. Okay? And the title of the article is Lehigh Valley College Students Say Schools Should Have Done More to Prepare for a Slew of Breakthrough Cases. Now, look. The Morning Call, right, has basically shred its newsroom. Right? So I don't want to be, I want to recognize that before I'm going to say what I'm going to say about the freaking lazy reporting that is in here. And I don't know if that's a function of Anthony Salamone's, or I don't know if that's a function of the editorial board at the Morning Call. All right. So I'm just going to read, I want to read you the first opening paragraphs here, and then I want to get to just the, you know, the most, the initial most blatant, I don't know what to call it. An error? That'd be generous. So, here we go. So, Lafayette College has an isolation house on the corner of Cattell and Clinton Terrace for students with COVID-19. Right, that was a picture of the isolation house. That was actually part of the caption. My bad. Sorry. Here we go. College students across the Lehigh Valley have been back on campus about 1 month. And while most students and faculty hope it will mark a full return to the academic and social life denied them over a year and a half, some say they worry about being in classrooms and social events amid the petri dish spread of the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus. Okay? So far, so good. Good opening. Even with required masking and vaccinations, students are still catching the virus. At Lafayette College, nearly all of the more than 2,500 students, 96.7% at the Easton School, are vaccinated, the college says. But 145 students tested positive during 1 week this month, and nearly 175 since the start of the fall semester. Okay, starts with Lafayette College. Next, Lehigh University's dashboard shows a total of 364 cases of the virus among students since August 9th, with a peak of 251 cases during the week of August 30th. Those numbers have diminished greatly, according to the school's data. Okay? Now, Kutztown University, so now we get the third one, right? Which has about 7,500 students, estimates 136 students and employees have been known to have tested positive for the virus since August, according to its most recent data. It was a similar trend to last year, 2 or 3 weeks into the semester, Kutztown spokesperson Matt Santos said. Okay. Here's the problem. Kutztown University does not require students to tell the university if they're vaccinated or not. You get that? The data that Kutztown University has says have been known to test positive. And there's like voluntary reporting requirements. You've heard me talk about this on this show. You've heard us talk about Out the Coop. You've seen the stories about this, right? And Kutztown University is put next to Lafayette University and Lehigh University And it's not even acknowledged that the Kutztown University is estimating because they don't know. And they're not trying to know. I am so furious. A little bit later on, data from other Lehigh Valley schools' dashboards, Moravian, DeSales Universities, and Cedar Crest and Muhlenberg Colleges, appeared to show a few cases of the virus. Diana Dimitrov, executive director of the six-member Lehigh Valley Association of Independent Colleges, which excludes Kutztown, said each school has a public dashboard on its website providing information and updates about the virus. Right. The greatest thing about the dashboards, right, if you go to the range of different dashboards, you reach COVID dashboard, whatever, Kutztown University is one, you know, this is, you know, I'm sorry, this is just freaking insidious to me. Instead of saying a COVID dashboard, because people are coming to looking for COVID statistics, they're going to be searching for COVID dashboard or searching for COVID numbers, right? Instead, Kutztown calls it a health update for the KU campus. And while they were estimating at the time of this article, which was yesterday, that they had 136 cases, as of today, they estimate there's 152 cases. Why? Because it's voluntary reporting. And some students, look, I tell you, a lot of the students, they're doing the right thing. But there's no requirements. A little bit further. At Lehigh, Lafayette, and other area universities, as they grapple with updates and revisions on COVID-19, students as well as college officials are charged with making serious health-related decisions. Lafayette students said college officials who earlier this year required students to be vaccinated against COVID are essentially doing their best to mitigate the spread of the virus. Lafayette required them to do the vaccination. But at state-run Kutztown, where vaccines are not mandated, college leaders have faced a backlash from some students and faculty. One faculty member said he is having to deal with the loss of income because his health issue prevents him from teaching his class. "The difference this year, we know a lot more about COVID than we did last year," said Matt Santos of Kutztown, which is one of the only campuses statewide that reopened a year ago. "But I will say that as August came around, we had to look at our protocols, and that included resuming mask wearing at indoor events, some COVID testing, and more." Now, that one faculty member, they talk about it, that one faculty member a little bit later, that is Steve Oros. You have to dig till you get there. And it says, like, one faculty member said he is having to deal with the loss of because his health issues prevents him from teaching his class. No. Kutztown University prevented him from teaching his class. Why? Because his doctor said he is not cleared to teach at a university in person that has the protocols, the lax protocols that Kutztown University does. Because why? Because he could die from it. Because he recently had a heart transplant. How do you bury that as a journalist? Seriously. One more. We finally get like three pages in, right? This is the printed version. We finally get to Steve Oros' case, right? So let's see how they frame this. At least one faculty member believes his life could be threatened by teaching face-to-face. Quote, "It's completely unsafe for me now," unquote, said Steve Oros III, a professor for 20 years who underwent a heart transplant in February. Quote, "Frankly, I would prefer to teach in person, but my doctors won't give me clearance for that," unquote. The psychology professor said on three occasions he asked that Kutztown, which last year had 50% of its courses online, but changed course after Governor Tom Wolf's emergency declaration was lifted earlier this year, allow him to resume teaching remotely in the fall. Kutztown denied his request, Oros said, though the college offered him an alternative, teaching new online courses only. Santos said this semester about 20% of classes are online. Last year it was 50%, 5% were in person, and blah, blah, blah. Just gives these numbers. They offered him an alternative. They finally get to it, right? Here it is. Oro said he received a letter about the new online psychology classes the Friday before the beginning of the semester. You heard the interview with him on this show. You know the story. They denied his request and said, good luck to you. You're going to have to file an ADA request for accommodation, but good luck with that. And of course, he files it and they deny him that ADA request because it would fundamentally change everything. It would fundamentally change the nature of the course. We just went through a year of changing the delivery of these courses and we're told to be flexible, right? And now they're saying that, no, we can't do that. But at the last minute, like 3 days before the beginning of the semester, say, we got an alternative. We have these high demand psychology classes that you can teach. And so Steve Oros goes to his chair and says, what courses are they talking about? And the chair of the department says, got me. You got me. I don't know what they're talking about. And then he asked the university, What courses are you talking about? Can you give me more information about them? And they refused to respond to his inquiries. This story makes it sound like, hey, the university was trying to work with him. And so they offered him an alternative, but he said no. Quote, it's a bit disheartening to think that you've worked for a place for 20 years and to see them treating other faculty and students just destroy, treating other and faculty and students this way just destroys any trust you have in them, Oro said. I don't know how I can recover from the belief in anything, they say. Santos declined to address Oros' case specifically, citing federal law. Quote, but as a university, he said, quote, we made every effort to accommodate leave requests for our employees within the parameters of the laws and regulations, and that is a lie. That is a lie. They did not do everything they could to do that. They did not. I read for you on last week's show, I think it was, example of this, right? So it wasn't just faculty members, all right? KUA, KU activists, right, are posting stories by students. Here, I'll read it to you again. I'm a disabled student who had all of my classes accommodated for the 2020-2021 school year to be online. I am at high risk for COVID-19 complications, but was forced to come back to campus even though I do not feel safe. When I asked the DSO, the Disability Services Organization, before the semester started what they were going to do to support students like me, this was the response I got. There will be no support. This is the response I got. As a senior, none of my classes are offered virtually. So I was told their option for me is to transfer. They act like they need money, yet they tell me to leave. I've had to transfer multiple classes due to my professors refusing to wear a mask. How about that? Even some of the professors do. And here's what they said. Here's your options for the fall. Work with your advisor or department chair to adjust your course schedule to fully online courses. If you're unable to enroll in all online courses, you can consider taking a leave of absence for the fall semester. You can contact the registrar's office. Here, you go over here and call them for more info. And while you're on a leave, you may consider taking some online classes at another university. To ensure the course is transferred back to KU, you should consult with your advisor and make sure that, you know, you get a permit to study at another college and make sure they're going to transfer and all that stuff. On option three, you may explore options for transferring to an online university that specializes in online or more remote study options. This is disgusting. This is what charter schools do to kids with disabilities. Once you privatized, quote unquote, publicly funded education, once you privatize that, and once you have this kind of mentality, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure that those students who are going to drive down your testing scores, Kutztown's like flashing its gun, hey, look, we made U.S. News and World Report's best colleges thing again. Yeah, you know how you do that? You try to drive out the problems and you put a nice glossy PR edge on everything else. And you look, this article from the Morning Call was published yesterday. It's a Sunday paper. That means it's widely read. There have been multiple articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer, obviously our podcast. There's different TV shows where they've been covered, even the case of Steve Oros. And to try to make it sound like the university, to allow a statement to say that the university did everything that it could to accommodate them is just it's disheartening to say the least. So oh boy. You know, I was also there's this really good article by Marie Solis in the in these Times this week. It's published on Friday. It's called "For Many, the Pandemic Was a Wake-Up Call About Exploitative Work," and she says in this, "Look, a pernicious corporate narrative suggests that workers like Lily," she gives this case where Lily, "who ask for a decent wage and a marginal flexibility from an employer, that they're simply lazy. Many understaffed employers have chalked up their problems to workers coasting on unemployment benefits or stimulus checks. They complained about federal unemployment supplements in the states that have loosened the strings on unemployment payments, such as requirements to continually search for a job or to accept any offer. But the 26 mostly red states that recently terminated the $300 weekly unemployment supplement from the American Rescue Plan, purportedly to incentivize workers, they did not see an immediate increase in job searches. Many workers have valid reasons to not return to work, regardless of any incentives, like the exorbitant cost of childcare, for example, being concerned about contracting COVID-19. To deem this unemployed behavior lazy, however, one must be predisposed to thinking work is some sort of moral imperative. And this gets to something that I want to come back to, why I want to read this part. Rarely have workers had the freedom to be selective about where, when, and how much they work, to decide their own fates. In light of this profound shift, perhaps it's understandable that workers are unwilling to settle. There are some more existential questions, too. Workers are reevaluating what role work should have in their lives, whether it's important to their senses of self, what they would do with their time otherwise. Some may decide the jobs they left are what the late anthropologist David Graeber termed bullshit jobs. Work, quote, that is so completely pointless, unnecessary, or pernicious that even the employee cannot justify its existence. After such a revelation, how could employers expect workers to return to business as usual? And then she goes in and talks about this Kathy Weeks' book, The Problem with Work, and the refusal to work. Right? Now, look, I'm bringing this up for a couple of reasons. There's some great stories in that piece by Maria Solis. I highly recommend it. I'll try to remember to put this in the show notes for today. But, you know, we have this, it's been drilled into our brains about this moral imperative to work, right? And that how everything, our self-esteem, how our you know, our worth, our whether we'll be judged as an upstanding citizen or upstanding individual or not, right, is based upon how hard we're going to work and our willingness to work and continues to work and always want to work. And that narrative's whatever. I mean, it's got some value, I guess. But that narrative says nothing about the conditions under which we toil. And at what point it becomes unbearable, psychologically, emotionally, economically, to continue riding the conveyor belt or keeping that conveyor belt moving. You know, and Solis makes a good point here is that, you know, look, in the 1970s, let me see if I can pull that out of this article real quick. Says the current historical moment isn't without its precedent. A kind of mass work refusal took place in the 1970s when 1 in 6 union members went on strike, demanding more control over the workplace, places, and more dignity. But the anti-work flashpoint was quickly co-opted by managerial initiatives as an excuse for work intensification, Weeks says. More participatory, multi-skilled, and more team-based work so you could feel better and work longer and harder. Right, so we had this moment, right? We had this moment in the 1970s when you had massive amounts of strikes. It was organized refusal to work. It wasn't just you as an individual making up the mind if you're going to go out and kind of like, you know, start a YouTube channel or try to get famous on TikTok or something like that. Not you as an individual. But you thinking about, I mean, this is like, it goes back to 1912, the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. We want bread, yes, but we want roses too. We want bread, yes, but we want roses too. And Solis makes the point in here. So, you know, one of the things, and I've spoken about this actually about my own experience in COVID, but she says, you know, COVID was a forced pause on our routines. It forced us to stop. It forced us to confront huge challenges. And for some people, it forced them to work in intolerable conditions. You know, there's this old union song. It's a wobbly song, IWW, right? So you will be by and by to that glorious time in the sky. Work and pray, live on something like that. You'll have pie in the sky when you die. Hey, Shireen, good to see you. Shireen dropping in. The whole idea, Utah Phillips did a version of the song, was great. That glorious time in the sky. The idea that, you know, you're going to struggle, you're going to have to pull through, but you know what? You'll get your payoff in heaven. And you talk about the way that Salvation Army used to come into workers' camps, right? And basically say, yeah, I know you got black lung. Yeah, I know you lost your limb in the meatpacking plant. Yeah. I know that you're kind of being crushed under the wheels of the machine, but you know what? You'll be rewarded in heaven. So keep on trucking in. Here are some extra clothes to keep you going. Here's some soup to fill your bellies. Right? The Salvation Army acted as the Band-Aid, the emotional, spiritual Band-Aid. But they weren't going to change the conditions. Nope. That's what the Wobblies were trying to do. That's what the IWW was going to do. in Lawrence, Massachusetts, when those women strike, primarily women strike, I think there's like something like 20 plus languages that were spoke as part of that strike. You know, you hear, I swear to God, I work at a union shop, and when I hear some of the complaints about the difficulty of work, I'm looking like, are you kidding me? You had a massive textile strike at a time where sexism was rampant, right? Immigrant women were the primary workers in these textile mills, speaking all sorts of different languages, and they had a huge strike, you know? I mean, come on. They didn't have legal protections. They didn't go to their lawyers and say, is it okay if we refuse to work? You say it might be a problem. Okay, I guess we'll go back. No. They had something to fight for, and they were fighting for it. And so the bread and roses thing, the whole idea. I mean, I still sign a lot of my emails, bread and roses. It's that reminder that, yes, we got a wage coming in. And we need that to survive in this freaking capitalist economy that is organized around questions of greed and misappropriation of wealth, the extraction of wealth from our labors. So we know. We're not idiots. We know we need a wage to survive. Are you kidding me? And there's people like me, right, who spent their life trying to work hard so I could kind of have a little more, be a little bit more comfortable. I chose to turn down a job that paid me more, even because this was a union job, and I knew I was going to have health insurance for a change. But at what point do we lose our freaking souls for the wage? Where's the dignity? And I keep on bringing it back to this case of Steve Oros at Kutztown University. And look, I know there's 1,000 of those stories that are out there, right? You can tell me, you probably have people in your lives that are going through all sorts of struggles too as well. I certainly do. But the Steve Oros' case troubles me so much is because we have an institution, a university, that is actively refusing, is actively forcing a person to make a choice between their life and their livelihood. And then, in the worst turn that you could do, an institution for higher education, in my mind, right, is not only are you cruel, but then you send it to your PR machine to put a nice gloss on it and pretend that you're not. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. And then you know, Rick Smith used to talk about this as this kind of Stockholm syndrome, like this collective Stockholm syndrome, like that we've been so abused for so long. We're so used to being mistreated. We're so used to being told that we should accept the crumbs and just suck it up and move on, work harder. That we end up, not all of us, but a good chunk of folks, end up making excuses and arguments for the abuse, for the university. I don't mean the PR wing. He gets paid to do that garbage. I'm talking about other faculty members, other staff members. Well, there's nothing we can do. And, well, what else can we do? And we're here for the students, right? Yep. We're going to have to sacrifice a few of our own, but that's what we signed up for, isn't it? I don't know. Look, I've had a real, I don't know how explicitly I said this before, but I've had a real, like, personal crisis over what I do right now. And you know, for a while there, I thought that, you know, I thought that it was, you know, higher education was the problem. And look, I've got enough critiques of higher education and all this kind of stuff, and I have enough, you know, can talk about all the directions toward neoliberal higher education, things that are going. But, you know, I do, the crisis that I face has been, you know, I've come to realize is like, you know, I could blame structures all I want, but I'm also have to come to terms with the fact that maybe I am just not a person that is well suited for higher education. Because this has affected my own health. I mean, Steve Oros had a freaking heart transplant, right? But this, I don't even know what you call this. This kind of like living cruelty with a smile and like just overt lying. And having to live in that structure. I then feel like, look, our best attempts, right? I've been organizing at that place at Kutztown University for a long time. And our best attempts over the years have yielded very small gains. And it affects my health. My mental health, my physical health. And so I'm doing this dance these days about, you know, when can I break? I was researching like retirement like last week. Five more years till I hit the minimum. You know, and I think I've told this story about my mom before. My mom had a similar experience. I mean, she was a public school teacher. You know, first she ran her own nursery school. You know, I've talked about my sister was mentally disabled as a result of some medical malpractice. When she received the MMR shot, you know, when we were one, we have a family allergy to it. And, you know, so she eventually started her own nursery school. But I figured, you know, just it was, she wasn't earning enough. So she had a teaching degree. So she went back into teaching. And she loved it. You know, she worked in the inner city. She worked in some of the hardest schools to work in my town in Utica. Right. With some of the hardest kids and hardest and most difficult families, right? You know, by difficult, what I mean is like poor, right? Let's be clear, right? So in Utica, she was working with students that, you know, were the poorest, were the kind of like the, you know, at the losing end of the racist structures, right? You know, but she loved those kids, you know, and she gave her heart. And then over the years, as that standardized testing stuff came up, and then, you know, she taught kindergarten, right? And as they were forced more and more to stop doing the things that the kids needed, like basic nurturing and care and kind of listening and like cooperation skills, you know, and just like having the space and time and giving them time to develop, because so much of their lives already had been struggle. And now being told, nope, you have to meet this benchmark. And it came over time slowly to the point where she felt like her soul was dying. And the same thing is happening in higher education. At least that's been my experience. We're forced to jump through all these hoops around this kind of assessment stuff. And so assessment's so important. But these administrators, they will tell you, you sit there in a real, oh, look, just give us something we can work with so that we can report it to Middle States, because Middle States is telling us we need these numbers. So just give us some numbers. And when we give them really high quality assessment, they ignore it. I've told the story before. I remember Amanda Morris. She led this assessment campaign to try to save this one course called the English English 022's Introduction to College Composition. had all the data, had all the background, did all the research, did all, you know, the survey stuff, showed evidence over time. They said, we need more data. We need more data. We don't, gave it all, put all the findings in the first paragraph, had a meeting with the administration, and the administration said, well, you know, you really should have data that shows blah, blah, blah. And Amanda said to them, that's in the first paragraph. And they fumble and they look at it. Oh, they didn't even read the freaking report. So what are you to make of that, right? You know, you're asked to jump through all these hoops. You're asked to fill out all these papers. You're asked to spend all this time doing what amounts to busy work, bullshit work, as David Graeber would say. Just to keep the machine going. Of course people don't want to go back to work. I don't want to go back to work under those conditions. Anyways, we're coming up on time here too as well. Shireen says she's reading A Collective Bargain by Jane McAlevey. Jane McAlevey is awesome. Jane McAlevey is probably one of the most important reads of any organizer out there. She is unbelievable. Unbelievable. No Shortcuts, her book, became, I actually bought a bunch of copies when we were organizing for our strike. A bunch of copies of her book, No Shortcuts, and handed them out. Anybody who wanted them. Because she's right on the money. Oh, and by the way, this goes to Shireen too. Thank you for dropping off copies of Left Turn. There's this journal that's produced out of Lehigh Valley. It's called Left Turn. And Shireen had dropped me off a couple copies of this. And I'm actually going to reach out to some of the folks who have articles in there and potentially to the editor to see if we can get them on the show. That's one of the things I wanted to do last week, and it slipped my mind. And so it was that's a real possibility. Because one of the things I think is, you know, really important is that this is where we can make an impact, right? Is that we can have on our social movements and on the organizing level. So hopefully we're going to have them on the show some point too as well. So I guess a bit more of a fun. So this is kind of like for anybody out there, either tonight or, you know, some other time like this. So one of the things that I discovered, and again, thank you to my brother Ryan for bringing this up last time I was home. He started watching this show called The Dungeon Run. This is like probably the biggest, like, gaping segue. No segue. We just freaking jump a canyon and start again, right? So, okay, let me go. So The Dungeon Run is, it's a live show. And once a week, you know, they're playing Dungeons and Dragons, right? So, Farrah. Okay, I'll look out to Farrah. I'll reach out to Farrah, definitely. Yes, and so basically it's a weekly show, and you've got these five these people who are mostly actors who are actually playing D&D, and you got a dungeon master and things like this. Now, for those of you who've never played D&D and just whatever, bear with me for a second, but because it's I have to say, so the show just kind of like, you know, my brother was telling me about it, and like, you know, I played D&D for a while when I was younger, and mostly probably not till I was in college, really. I wish I had learned it earlier. There was other people in my life at that point when I was younger that would have played it, but I loved it. And that immersive storytelling and role-playing game, I was great. But it's been a long time. And, you know, I have some of the books still and things like this. But anyway, so he tells me about this thing, and he told me about it. This was like in August. And, you know, I was like, well, I came back from a trip to see my folks and had to, you know, finish all my preparations for the semester and load things up online and do my syllabi, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that work doesn't require a ton of concentration, like, you know, like reading. Like a lot of the reading stuff I had already done. So it was a matter of kind of organizing stuff and doing, you know, just some of the main mundane tasks of kind of preparing for the semester. And so I would listen to, I would have the Dungeon Run on. And so it started in 2019, but it's on caffeine.tv and caffeine TV, but it has a YouTube channel. And so you can basically go back and watch it from the beginning. And so I started doing that. Right. And so I just have it on in the background as I was doing it. And then I got just really like into it. Right. And so then when I was kind of driving places, I would listen to it in the podcast version and I just love it. It was just great. And it's like the guy, the Jeff Cannata, who's the DM, the dungeon master for the show and the host. He's just a phenomenal storyteller, right? Just does a great job of crafting it all. And so it just brought me back into this, you know, that feeling of joy of doing something that was just fun, you know, and imaginative and creative. And, you know, and for the longest time, I would basically tell myself that I shouldn't do those things. You know, this is just sad on my part. I mean, for whatever, that's the conversation I have with myself these days. It's like, you know, like I should be working. I shouldn't, you know, I don't have time to be, you know, playing games. You know, and then I swear to God, my kids are my saviors, right? It's like, find out that my son, right? We had gotten the starter kit a few years ago, and then we played with my son and my daughter and one of my son's friends and my niece, and just the starter kit. And it kind of like, you know, the first time round, it was just, you know, whatever. I mean, just kind of basically made up most of the rules as I was going, because just, you know, they were just interplaying whatever. So I did that, came up with my own little like mini campaign and things like that. But now they're kind of getting more and more interested in it. And, you know, my son came up with this really cool character, and he played it once and I was like, whoa, he really knows how to play this character. And my daughter's all into this. And so I'm like, oh, this is great. So we're kind of, you know, back and starting to do this again. And now I'm actually designing this own campaign. I've got this kind of cool map making program and stuff. And of course I don't have a ton of time to devote to this, but it's just like, it was just beautiful and creative, right? And imaginative. Like, I just find it just like some space to breathe and how important that was. But I tell you all that. So I'm actually at the beginning points of designing a campaign. We've got this other from the starter kit. It's like the, it's like a starter campaign, the Lost Mines of Phandalin or something like Phandalin or something like that. I know there's people like shaking their heads at me right now, but whatever, I'm horrible with the names. And I've never DM'd before up until just now, right? So I've never kind of been the dungeon master, just my own campaigns, stuff like that. So if there's any people out there to listen to this, right, have got some tips for setting up a campaign or things that they wish they knew when they started or that kind of thing, I welcome it, because I'm really enjoying kind of starting to design a particular campaign and kind of getting lost a little bit on the weekends a little bit to do something that kind of is creative for, like, you know, because we need bread, yes, but we need those roses too. And, you know, right now this is my roses. So, oh boy. All right. Well, we're just about 10 after 8 every night, everybody tonight. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in who did. Shireen, thanks for popping in the chat. And thanks to all of you who have continued to support the show over the years, right? Thanks to all of our members. Thanks to all of our patrons. Thanks for those of you who share the show. Every time an announcement goes out, I see these like rapid tweets that go out to, you know, people who are tweeting out at the content and stuff like that. So thank you for all your support. And we'll have some more stuff coming up this week, this Wednesday. We will not have a Wednesday with Cyril this week. Cyril, long story short, we couldn't get our schedules to work this week. But we'll be back on Friday, where Sean and I will kind of break down the good, bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And I'm going to keep on plugging away at trying to see what we can do for guests for next week. Hopefully, I'm going to be able to, you know, kind of nail down a couple times where things are going to work out. But it's just, you know, it's a little bit more tricky now that I'm back teaching and don't have the same kind of flexibility that I did, obviously, over the summer. So there we go. Anyways, thanks, everybody. Good see out there tonight. Hopefully you've been enjoying this kind of amazing fall weather, and hopefully that you're staying healthy. I know that I hear more and more cases of kids in school and things like this coming down with COVID, or I know I have a bunch of students at Kutztown University where I teach have been out. Some of them tell you that they have COVID. Other ones, you don't know why they're sick and they've just been out for several days. And, you know, it's not my business to kind of pry into their, you know, lives. And the university doesn't have any mandatory reporting requirements. So who the heck knows? But it is what it is. All right. So thanks, you all, for tuning in. And we're going to see you right back here next Monday night at 7 p.m. And we'll see you late Friday morning again this week with Sean Kitchen and I. Break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You know, until then, man, it just seems like there's so much to do, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Anyways, until then, you know, keep fighting out there. Keep struggling. Take care of each other. Stay healthy. We'll talk to you soon. Patreon.com/RCPress. Become a patron. See ya! I'll fly away.